Graham Turner is a professor of cultural studies at the University of Queensland and the author of Ordinary People and the Media. This is Graham Turner. I'm Duncan Gammy. You're listening to Dunk Tech.
Great. I am here with Graham Turner. Thank you, sir, for joining me today.
You're welcome.
So I wanted to talk to you because you've written a number of things, but a couple of interesting books in particular that I read about celebrity. And you're a scholar. You presumably could be studying and writing about a number of different topics. And celebrity, to some people, might come across as being a superficial subject. I don't think that's the case, but why in particular were you interested in celebrity?
Yes, it's a fair question because I'm actually not interested in celebrities at all. Like I don't follow celebrities personally. What happened with that was I was doing some work on changes to the structure and content of news organizations, particularly around current affairs, around in the 1990s. And one of the things that I came across was just increasing evidence of the shift in content in news and the increasing amount of celebrity content. And it became clear that celebrity content was becoming one of the real kind of core components of the industry into the future. And it helped a lot of the mass market women's magazines survive. And you could see that as print media started to come under a little bit of pressure as we see online alternatives start to develop, that celebrity was one of the ways that online media attracted attention, and it was one of the ways that traditional print media felt they had to compete. And so what you found was just this exponential growth in content. And this is before we're even looking at, you know, the micro celebrity or the influencers or any of that. This was just in relatively traditional provision of news. And so I started to look at what was happening around celebrity, really in terms of how the industry was being restructured. And it seemed to me that celebrity, the whole kind of infrastructure around celebrity, publicity, promotions, all of that, had now become a much more crucial part of the way the media industries work. And so that's why I started to look at it in more detail to see what the function of celebrity was within the industry, and to a lesser extent, but still there, what the function of the celebrity was for consumers, for people who followed it.
It's interesting that you hook it into the decline of print media as being sort of a reason for why this celebrification of our culture took off. Could you expand on that? Why did this trend begin?
It's interesting. It's hard to actually nail down why it began, but it does seem that there were competing influences, particularly online, but not just online. The way television had changed meant that there was competing avenues for attention. And one of the big ones, for instance, was reality TV. So you suddenly had a change in the way the production of celebrity happened. Instead of celebrity being hooked up to the entertainment industry in terms of publicizing particular products, you know, a film or a TV series or whatever, you had television companies producing celebrities kind of out of whole cloth themselves and cutting out the middleman. So you had a new production line of celebrity. And one of the things about that production line that reality TV in particular provided was they were easily replaceable. But they were celebrities that didn't have long-term lives. And so they were a great commodity because you could keep on inventing new celebrities and attracting audiences. You didn't have to sustain the old ones and manage their career. You didn't have to pay them very much. You simply had to offer them the opportunity to be on television. And people, not only did people accept that, but in many cases, you know, the people we talked to, myself and I know in Mark Andreevich's work too, a lot of the people that we talked to who'd been involved in reality television, particularly early on, saw it as a kind of validating and empowering experience because they were suddenly on TV. And that was like entering a higher order of legitimation, I suppose, as people. And so that you've got that influence happening. You've got the kind of death throes of the mainstream women's magazines that ramped up their treatment of celebrity as a way to stave off their demise. You know, and that happens from the mid 80s on. And it's taken a long time, but we're watching it pretty well dead now. And you can see the newspapers trying to find new ways of attracting audiences that was not about generating news. So at the same time, the number of journalists were shrinking, they were downsizing. And so what they wanted was ready-made material that could go into print straight away. And most of the celebrity material that we looked at when we were doing the Australian book in 2000 was press releases that basically went in untouched. It just went to the journalists, they printed it. And so it was actually a really efficient mode of production for celebrity, but it also bypassed most of the standard editorial practices that news had been using. So there are a whole lot of factors that came together. And then, you know, much later on, of course, you have the idea that ordinary people themselves could become celebrities by taking hold of those processes of production online that focused on gaining attention for you as a person or as a performing person, I suppose, online. So that exacerbated it even further. But so you're looking at, I don't know, maybe a 20, 30-year trajectory of competing influences, that not just about technological change, but about changing audiences' patterns of consumption and also changes in the financial structure of the industries themselves.
Yeah, it's definitely a confluence of influences. What's interesting when you talk about reality TV is the fact that even though a lot of people look at reality TV rightfully as being staged or quote unquote scripted, you don't have to pay writers in the same way that you would for a show like a Seinfeld. Did you find that it was mostly economic factors then driving this transformation?
Well, certainly it, I mean, for instance, just give you one example of how that can work. In Australia, there are local content requirements upon the local broadcast television channels. They have to broadcast a certain amount of local material. And reality TV is fantastic because instead of having to write drama and cast drama and pay all the production costs involved with the dramatic series, reality TV is actually quite cheap, and you don't have to pay participants much. And in many cases, their careers are tied to that production later on, so you're getting free publicity for the network for the next version of it and so on. So there are lots of economic reasons why reality TV formats became so desirable for the television producers. And of course, the thing about reality television when it first started, you know, with Big Brother, was that it was kind of an event. It's not so much anymore, but when it started, you know, it was real water cooler television because everybody had to watch it because it was such a weird experiment to have, you know, 20 odd cameras following people 24 hours a day and then streaming it live. And
Big Brother, was that an Australian reality show? I'm not familiar with that.
Big Brother, well, that's interesting because Big Brother was actually a Dutch show run by Endemol, and it was franchised all around the world. There were American versions of Big Brother.
Okay.
It was probably early in that 2000-2010 with its heyday, so it's a good 10 years ago.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that you haven't heard of it, because in many ways 10 years ago it would have been impossible not to have heard of it.
Yeah.
And so it was an event. It was a bit, I suppose, comparisons to something like The Bachelor, maybe.
Okay.
But it was much more radical because it was unheard of to have people being followed by cameras. And there was this assumption that it was a documentary, you know, that it was true.
Right.
Now we've grown up and we realize that reality TV is, you know, is still TV rather than reality. And but early on, you know, that wasn't the case. And a lot of the people who produced early reality TV were documentary producers. And that was their kind of ethical orientation. So it's quite different initially to what it's become, where the kind of game show element has increased, and also an awful lot of television that's reality TV now is actually about humiliating and embarrassing people rather than doing anything that a documentary maker might have wanted to do.
Well, why do you think that's something worth touching on? Well, why do you think that is? A lot of reality TV and a lot of the way we sort of the way people get famous is through humiliating or shameless behavior. Like we're very attracted to that. And even things that, you know, people mock the Kardashians and yet they can't look away. Well, do you have any insight into why that is?
There are lots of thoughts about why that is. And hang on, that's my phone just going off. I'll turn it off.
No.
There are lots of reasons for it. I mean, partly it's just that the function of media has become oriented, or at least the media industries has been oriented around the competition for attention. And one of the ways you get attention is, well, you can get more attention by doing nasty, shocking things than you can by doing nice things. And so while there are certainly reality TVs that are kind of pro-social and positive, there are many more that are not. And I think they do have to try to compete by being more outrageous than the other. Why we're interested in that is a more complicated question. One of the things, there was some research done on in Britain around a program that you might have come across. There was an American version of this called Wife Swap. And Wife Swap, the premise for that was that people swapped wives for a couple of weeks. So, you know, the partnership was between couples was dissolved for a week and they swapped houses. I mean, there wasn't a sexual involvement, but they just had to show how difficult it was living with somebody else's partner. And of course, what it was about people arguing and behaving badly. And they would have a middle class couple swap wives with a working class couple. And so there'd be enormous differences in the value structure. And the work that Bev Skeggs did in the UK with Helen Wood described the way in which people watched those programs as very active and engaged in what they described as tournaments of value, so that they were kind of arguing about the values that were there. And so while yes, they're watching because of the spectacle of humiliation, which, like you say, draws your attention, you can't look away, it was also one of the ways in which they sort of worked through arguments about what's valuable and what isn't. Sometimes, you know, I guess watching the Kardashians, they could come up with a conclusion saying the Kardashians are completely trivial and superficial, but let's watch them. Or they might come up with the conclusion that actually I want to be like them. And what Skeggs and Wood were arguing was that the format actually holds both possibilities. And I think that's true of reality television in general. Sarah Bernay Wiser talked about it being both empowering and exploitative at the same time. You know, both potentials are there, both for the people involved, you know, those on television, and for us watching. So it's that complexity, I think, that makes it hard to look away. I mean, it may sound a bit, you know, implausible to talk about reality television as being complex.
Yeah, sure. You
know, it may look pretty simple, but I think the way in which we're attracted to it and the way in which it intervenes in the social is actually quite complicated.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons that makes it successful.
Yeah, reality TV as a phenomenon is complex. The actual programming itself is very simple. But the interesting part that you just said, the fact that it's empowering for people and the fact that celebrity is such a value and an aspiration for people and for ordinary people, like young people, at least in America today, from 16 to 25, the most desired job is to be a professional YouTuber, to just have, you know, some famous social media presence. Why do you think this has become such a like a prized possession?
I think that there are a number of people who talked about this in the past. Nick Coldry in particular has talked about it. And the argument that I'm convinced by is that being on television, being visible on television and being available to an audience is a kind of higher order of reality, that once you've achieved that, you know, if you lifted out, you have been lifted out of the ordinary and made exceptional. And that seems to be an appreciation of you. And one of the things that puzzled me about all this when it started was how come people were being made celebrities without any obvious talents? You know, they were just regular folk who just happened to get lucky or were prepared to put up with whatever happened to them on television in order to be on television. And I think the argument about that is that that's in fact one of the things that makes it so powerful, that they're not actually being celebrated because they've got talents or, you know, have sporting achievements or are wonderful actors. They're just being celebrated because they are who they are on television. And so that seemed to be kind of personally validating in ways that transcend what's available to them in the rest of their ordinary lives. And so it seems to me that that's the kind of area that you look at that television has managed to convince, and I think it's television initially and now video, it's managed to convince people that gaining visibility and gaining followers and likes and so on online is a personal validation. And so that's why they want to pursue it, because that's what they get. And they don't get that, you know, you don't get likes in other parts of your life. People don't give you a thumbs up all the time in other parts of your life. So it's very attractive. But of course, it's very attractive, as you say, in particular to young people who are trying to develop a sense of their own identity. And that is that age group that you just described. And so that's also kind of worrying, because this is all bogus, you know. This is an incredibly ephemeral kind of achievement. Now, in some areas like social media or entertainment, I think you can argue that there has been a whole area of entertainment developed on YouTube and other channels that do provide an option for people to create their own content and be creative and so on. I think that does happen. But I think in the world of the influencers and the micro celebrities, I think, you know, that's a kind of full-blown commitment to an entirely illusory form of self-fashioning. And that's a worry.
Well, what you said just now about the fact that young people in particular are affected by it because they're searching for this identity, that, and they're also searching for some sort of self-worth. And the fact that you could get a quick and cheap form of self-worth and what you described as being, you're not being valued for a talent. If anything, it's even more pure. You're being valued entirely yourself. That is, hey, has that ever happened before in human history, that form of fame?
I don't think so, actually. That's an interesting question. No, I don't think so. I mean, it's one of the distinctions between stars and celebrity. The stars are people who've got actually a record of having done something that's brought them into public prominence, and then they become stars. And people who are famous, you know, tend to have that record as well. Whereas celebrities tend to be people who actually just are available, have achieved visibility rather than anything else. And so I can't think of any prior. I mean, my view is that celebrity, as we know it, is only made possible by mass media. There's debate within celebrity studies over that, and people talk about 19th century versions of celebrity. I actually do think that celebrity is made possible by the spread of mass media. So, you know, it could only have happened in the last 100 years. I guess the other point to make about what you were saying, though, is that while these likes and these ticks of approval and so on are wonderful validations of self-worth, it also works the other way, that if they get attacked, you know, that can be devastating too. So it's a really nasty little trap that Sarah has described, that ambivalence between the exploitative and the empowering. You know, it can be, because it can happen to the one person at almost the same time, it's both good and bad.
Well, yeah, the building people up and then tearing them down. You see that with people like Justin Bieber, who came out through YouTube and was built up as this pop idol and became so famous that eventually the cool thing to say was, oh, I hate this guy. And then once everyone hated him, then the cool thing to say was, well, you know what, yeah, guy's all right.
Yeah, that's right.
What is behind that pendulum? That's a weird mass psychology.
Look, I honestly don't know what drives that. There are so many influences upon those kind of public reactions, and some of those are driven deliberately and externally. In some cases by publicity and promotion companies, and sometimes for other reasons. So it's really hard to tell what's the kind of fundamental set of factors that are driving it. I mean, you can look at individual cases and say, well, that's what happened there. But it does seem that people just get bored, you know, that there's a level of engagement that eventually, I guess, probably put it this way, that the level of engagement in the first place is relatively superficial. You know, there's not a lot of commitment there. And so it can quite easily be shifted. You know, I used to like Justin Bieber, but now I've found out that he does X, and so I don't like him anymore. So, you know, that tends to happen if you don't have a very strong commitment. If you're a fan, a real fan, then what you would be saying was, people say this bad stuff about Justin Bieber, but I don't believe any of it. But what we're talking about really is the mass of people who are consuming in a relatively superficial way. They're just grazing across the surface of celebrity and picking up things. But they're often the people who go online and say really awful stuff.
Yeah, that's well, one of the things you also mentioned in there was the effect of mass media being the way that modern celebrity can happen. I was reading this article by Ta-Nehisi Coates, where, you know, famous writer, and he was talking about his own experience, his limited experience with fame. And Ta-Nehisi Coates is well known if you read like nonfiction, but he's not necessarily a household name. But he has probably, just as a function of modern media, is more recognizable, more talked about, tweeted about than a lot of major celebrities in, you know, from classical history. That is something that's new. Do people in celebrity studies dispute this, or what's the argument there?
No, I don't think they would dispute it. I think that the actual economy of celebrity has changed dramatically. And I think that to some extent it's, whereas it was something that the mainstream entertainment industry thoroughly controlled initially, I don't think that's the case anymore. And so, you know, one of the reasons I think people thought the promotion of the self via online visibility was going to be a positive thing was because it did offer the possibility for non-mainstream new voices, etc., to be heard. You know, that certainly there are two sides to that argument, but that is one of the things that has changed. And it's meant that a range of people who weren't really products of mainstream promotional industries actually achieve a level of visibility that they wouldn't have been able to achieve previously.
And speaking of which, your book, Ordinary People in the Media, which was quite prophetic about the insertion of ordinary people into the status of celebrity. With the massive growth of social media, especially since it helped launch the presidency of our current president, is there anything, do you have any new thoughts on that book?
Yeah, look, a lot of that book was was trying to warn people that the enthusiasm for the explosion of voices that were supposed to be happening online, I was trying to hose that down a little bit and say, well, that just because there's lots of voices, it doesn't mean they're all going to be democratic. And so there was an argument about the democratization that was going to be the result of the ordinary people's access to the internet. And there are a lot of very popular books. Clay Shirky's book, Here Comes Everybody, was one of those that was around at the time. And there was a lot of focus on the capacity for people to produce content online. And of course, you know, the number of people who did that was very small. And so it was always a focus upon what wasn't necessarily going to be a major element. And so a lot of the argument that I put forward in Ordinary People in the Media was trying to say, look, you need to think about the dual potentials that are available here. And just because lots of people get to post their views online doesn't mean that it's democratizing. It just means that there are lots of different people. And some of the it's just as easy for that potential to be used for hate speech and conspiracy theories and so on as it is for anything else. And certainly, I must admit, at the time I wrote that book, which is I think now 2009, 2010, I could never have predicted the extent that it's developed. I certainly couldn't have predicted the election of Donald Trump.
Sure.
But I'm not alone there.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that we underestimated the importance of anonymity online, that the affordance that provided people to bypass normal rules of kind of civil discourse and to avoid the responsibility for their utterances. And I think that's one of the key elements that was overlooked as being something seemed like a good idea at the time. But now looking at it, you see that actually an awful lot of what happens online that we don't want to happen online wouldn't be there if people weren't able to preserve their anonymity.
Absolutely. But it's also a weird question, because on the one hand, that's true. But on the other, you have countries where certainly people should have the space to be anonymous, or else they would be imprisoned or what have you. Do you see any good solution to that problem?
No, I don't actually. You're dead right. It's there are good reasons for preserving anonymity. I mean, I must admit, I come from a country that has had quite a strong history of media regulation. And so I would always look to forms of regulation as a way of doing this. And, you know, we had quite clear standards of regulation for print media and for television. But we've given social media a bit of a free pass on that. And I think that was a mistake, that there should have been a regulatory structure set up. Or even, you know, the issue about whether the social media platforms should be regarded as publishers rather than just communications companies.
Right.
If they're publishers and were then responsible for what they published, that would change. So, I mean, who knows if it's too late, you know, that the bull has bolted and there's no point closing the gate. But it does seem to me that some kind of international attention to providing a coordinated regulatory regime is worth pursuing. I mean, there are various countries pursuing it at the moment. I don't know how feasible it is anymore. But it does seem to me that it's worth pursuing, because some kind of regulatory structure that forced companies to do a lot more than they're doing now would help.
Well, you know what's interesting about that is I was just talking to this guy, Emerson Brooking, and he's an expert in information warfare. And speaking of celebrity and the toxic effect of social media, he was identifying how groups like ISIS use the same sort of Instagram tactics as people like Taylor Swift, of cultivating authenticity and you know, managing your brand and establishing an online presence. It's very weird to see how this it's a very amoral idea of celebrity, where it can be applied equally to a terrorist fighter, to Taylor Swift, to a Donald Trump, and be used sort of as a currency to gain whatever sort of power you want. Like, has celebrity always been just a means to an end in that sense?
Not to the extent that it is now, no. I mean, I think what's happened is that suddenly a whole set of tools were developed that enabled new forms of self-presentation and new ways of accessing an audience and new ways of collecting data that would help you do that. All of those things have changed quite dramatically in the last 15 years, really.
Yeah.
So I think what's happened is that all of those tools are initially, I think probably true to say that all of those tools were initially seen as positive, as enabling and opening access and all of those things that were supposed to be good. And yet the tools were value free. They didn't actually privilege certain kinds of content. They were simply there. And so what you've got is a whole bunch of tools that have no morals and have no regulatory structure and are deployable by absolutely anybody. And they work really well no matter who uses them. I mean, and that's the weird thing, that these are really good tools. They work. Mm-hmm. And so they're available for anybody to make use of. And nobody really thought about the implication, the politics of the tool itself. You know, nobody really thought enough about that. Certainly I got involved in lots of arguments about that, you know, 10, 15 years ago. But it was very hard to convince the people that I call in the book you're referring to, I call them digital optimists, the ones who are always looking at on the bright side of the potential. I always felt that they were being really naive and needed to be told that. But it was very difficult in the middle of the burst of enthusiasm for the online environment opening up to ordinary people. It's very, very hard to get people to listen to that argument. Now, you know, they're all making that argument, you know, they've seen what it's become. But 10 years ago, there was a lot of resistance to seeing that these tools didn't necessarily serve a democratic or expressive function that was always going to be pro-social.
There was a lot of enthusiasm back then. Almost all the articles about tech companies were really positive. And now, especially Facebook, they're very negative, or at least tend to be.
Yeah.
What were those arguments like at the time the book was published? What were people saying to you?
Well, some of it was really weird. That one of the things I said in the book was that instead of talking about democratization and, you know, the democratic term, In media, we should be talking about it as demotic, that is, of the people, but with no actual politics implied. It was a full range. And people would say, what do you mean, demotic? You know, what does that? They actually didn't know what the word meant. In fact, the book has got a little definition of it in the front page, right, so that people will know what I'm talking about. That's always a bit of a worry. But it was, you know, I found myself having to argue with colleagues who were saying, why is that an important distinction between the democratic and the demotic? And to say to them, well, one's got assumes a particular political potential, the other doesn't. And that's important if you're going to talk about what this stuff does socially. But there was just so much enthusiasm for, I think, the sense that mainstream traditional media were going to be challenged, and that the people who had the tools to challenge it were the people that had been ripping off for years and selling crap to and forcing them to watch television in linear schedules and so on. So there was this sense of a kind of freeing up of structures that would be positive. So that was the overwhelming tendency. And so to argue against that and say, well, hang on, this is not necessarily going to work out the way you think, just because it's an alternative of sorts to big media doesn't mean it's going to be any different to big media. And of course, the same people ended up controlling all media. And The internet is actually more concentrated in terms of ownership than the traditional media were, etc. So an awful lot of the assumptions that people had that made them so excited have turned out to be unfounded. But it really took quite a while for that to unfold. And, you know, now I don't think there's much argument about it anymore, but certainly there was when that book came out.
It's one of those things that it has now become so obvious that there's no real argument about it. But it's really funny to hear about a period of time not too long ago when people were still in the age of speculation about what this thing was going to be. And I think that distinction you made is really good about demotic versus democracy or democratizing, because democracy implies some form of organization too. And there's no organization of the voices. It's just a total fire hose of information. Anyone can participate, which is good because it lets a conversation like this happen. But also, speaking of podcasts, they're starting to get bought and gobbled up by companies like Spotify and so on. The consolidation of media in the internet, does that worry you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's not unsurprising, you know, the history of, you know, if you look at the history of media, and perhaps that's something that people needed to do earlier on, thinking this is all going to be different, if they looked at what had happened before, you know, the consolidation and concentration of ownership, all of those things are part of the history of media over this last 100 years, really. And the economic logic of that means that big players can swallow up smaller players because they can. And if they smaller players are challenging them, they can buy them up, you know. And that's pretty much, you know, when coming from the country that produced Rupert Murdoch, you know, I'm very sensitive to that. I mean, like Murdoch started out owning one newspaper in a minor city in Australia, and he now owns 67% of all print and electronic media in the country. And the other thing he does, he owns the only newsprint operation. So any competitor that starts up and needs to have their newspapers printed has to pay Rupert Murdoch to do it.
Wow.
So, you know, so looking at that, you say, well, that's kind of the logic. That's the political economy that we're facing. Now, to break that apart, you're going to have to find a way to compete with those big guys. Now, of course, Facebook and Google and Amazon have become big enough to do it, but now they're the problem.
Yeah.
You know, they are buying up smaller competitors like WhatsApp and so on. So that the same logic of acquisition and concentration and consolidation is going to happen, you know, whether you're looking at old media or new media, the same kind of economic forces are at work. So it hasn't changed all that much.
It hasn't. I guess the only, it feels psychologically different when you have a guy like Rupert Murdoch owning the literal mills that are printing newspapers, as opposed to a platform where theoretically anyone can publish on. Is that like a big issue in Australia? That seems like it would be, I mean, if you were an Australian, you'd be furious.
Yeah, it's not as big as an issue as it should be. I don't think. I think the media in Australia has they've not got a lot of political support in any kind of battle against Murdoch. Murdoch has always had good political antennae, and so there aren't too many major politicians in Australia who want to take Murdoch on, and so it's tricky. Also, the commercial media, it's only a relatively small set of commercial television stations, for instance. There are only four commercial ones in Australia, and they've always been seeking favours from government to make sure that they're viable, because for many years they weren't commercially viable because it's such a small market. And so where once upon a time the connection between media and government was actually restricted by regulation, actually, to maintain the independence of the media, that went years ago. And so now it's so tightly integrated that you wouldn't see, for instance, in art, too many articles in, or you wouldn't see too many television programs on commercial TV attacking Murdoch. That's left to the public broadcasting channel, which is funded by government, and so they get in trouble from government because they're attacking one of government's friends. So it's
it is
a source of debate in Australia, and it is a source of concern, but it's not, I don't think it's a source of popular concern.
That's interesting, though. Do people in public broadcasting get in trouble if they go after Rupert Murdoch?
Yeah, they do. I mean, it's masked, I suppose, in some ways. It's usually done under accusations of bias or left-leaning or whatever. It's not, you mustn't attack Rupert Murdoch. It's saying this is a very biased, one-sided view, and the public broadcasters are inhabited by, you know, latte-sipping lefties who really should get a proper job and so on. So you get that kind of culture war rhetoric happening around the ABC, which is the public broadcasting network here. So it is hard for them because government controls their funding, and their funding is only annual. And so the capacity for government to punish them is significant. And so they've become increasingly timid over the years as their funding has been cut, and as they keep getting warned it'll be cut further. There have been inquiries in the past to try and cut their engagement in news and current affairs on the argument that commercial broadcasting was covering that just as well. But so far those inquiries have failed because there is really strong popular support for the ABC and its news and current affairs programs.
That's really unfortunate, because what you're describing is a press that is not free in a practical sense. You know, that's
No, that's right. They're not. And practically, like theoretically they're free and independent, but practically they have to exercise that independence with a great deal of caution and strategic awareness of the context.
And you mentioned the culture war phenomenon there. And of course, in the States, we have our own culture war to similar effects. And it kind of wraps up this whole phenomena here with the presidency of Donald Trump, who is the ultimate celebrity, modern celebrity, I suppose. He's probably the most famous person in human history. There was some study done of all the if you just got free media, like how much it would cost to buy your name being printed in the New York Times and added up for all the other, you know, publications and so on.
Yeah.
On the basis of dollar amount, he was more famous in dollars than the next 7,000 famous people combined. That is a crazy amount of fame. When you were watching the 2016 election, were your spidey senses tingling at all when you saw the way he went about gaining power?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I was still incredulous, you know, that it happened.
Right.
But you could see that. Well, I guess what I was seeing from outside, I was in America for part of that time, but not for long, was just how gullible the news media were, and how the kind of focus on attention was skewing the coverage. And so the amount of time he was on television, even if he was being pilloried or shown doing stupid or disgusting things or whatever, the amount of time he was on television compared to Hillary Clinton was just ridiculous.
Right.
You know, there was no real equivalence in terms of the airtime being given them, and that was noticeable from outside, and certainly when I was in the States around that time, it was as well. So that bothered me, because I thought, well, if it's true that he does actually have a significant base of support, that mode of coverage is only going to strengthen that base. Mm-hmm. And make them feel that he's a thoroughly legitimate candidate. And at the beginning, of course, when he started his run, he was seen as a joke. And right. In a way, I think that the media's attempt to present him as a joke, personally, backfired, and it seemed to only validate him with people who thought the media were full of crap anyway. And so,
right.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I'm still staggered that Trump's in that position. And if he gets reelected, I'll be even more staggered, but who knows?
It's, yeah, I mean, who knows what's going to happen, but it'll be, regardless of the outcome, it's going to be a hellacious event. When you were talking about portraying him as a joke and the fact that he, the way he uses language is very, there are people out there who will call him like a blue collar guy, a blue collar way of speaking. And this is coming obviously from someone who's a billionaire, but he speaks in a very ordinary way, the way you might just hear common people talking. And as we're talking about ordinary people becoming celebrities, have you noticed like a corresponding phenomenon where celebrities are trying to act more and more like normal, quote unquote, people?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I do. Yeah. I think that's, and in a way, you know, it's, some of the platforms have developed precisely to allow that to happen. You know, that's kind of what makes Instagram work, isn't it? And and Twitter as well. So that, I mean, one of the really interesting things was that's happened is that all of a sudden celebrities have kind of taken a hold of their relationship with their audience by directly
yes.
dealing with them rather than through promotions or publicity people, but dealing with them via online social media. And so that is, you know, that's a significant shift. And one of the ways in which they operate there is by trying to show themselves as ordinary folks. And so you have lots of homey pictures, you have lots of pictures of them in their own environment. You don't necessarily have them. I haven't done a survey of this, but my guess would be that if you had to look at their feeds that they present through social media, you'd see a lot more about their home life and their domestic life than you would see about their professional life.
Right.
And of course, that's one of the things that determines a celebrity, really, that it's the difference between being famous for having done something and being a celebrity. What happens, sometimes people get famous for doing something and then become celebrities. And the turning point is when the interest in the media turns onto their private life rather than their professional life. And so that, you know, that's one of the things that happens in the process of celebrification. And so what you see celebrities doing now online through Instagram and Twitter and so on is representing themselves as ordinary people and representing their lives, although they're far from ordinary, but representing their lives as something that ordinary people can gain access to by watching.
It's a very weird phenomenon because there is something fake and artificial about going out of your way to appear ordinary. Yes. You know?
That's right.
Well,
there's a whole industry around authenticity. Sarah Bonet Weiser has written a great book called Authentic, and it's just about the way in which the notion of authenticity has been mobilized in popular culture in recent years. She talks about reality TV and advertising, a whole range of areas. But it does pick up the thing that you're pointing to, that notion of the production of authenticity, you know, that
right.
kind of oxymoron there, the production of authenticity is something that we now have a whole industry devoted to. And it's a bit like that old, you know, Richard Nixon quote about once you've learned how to fake sincerity, you've got it made.
I don't want to take up too much more of your time, so I just wanted to ask you, do you see this trend at all resolving itself, getting worse? Is there a way off this train?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't see it getting necessarily much worse.
Sure.
I mean, I think I think we're pretty near the peak of that. And I think there is a point where people's omnivorous consumption of a wide variety of media content is going to run out of gas. I think people have what John Ellis called choice fatigue. They, you know, that sooner or later they'll think, oh, the hell with trying to work out what I want to watch on Netflix. Maybe I'll just turn on broadcast and go with the linear schedule. There may be a bit of that going to happen. And I think that in another area, the rise of the influencer is a significant industrial figure within advertising and promotions. I think that's peaking now too, that I think the limits of, because it's become such a crowded field, you think, well, maybe the limits of that are being hit. But I don't see celebrity as a kind of institution disappearing. I think it's now hardwired into the media industries, and it would take quite significant shifts in the structure and operation of those industries to dislodge celebrities so we don't have them anymore. I don't think that's going to happen. In terms of the politics of all this, my worry is that the politics of the construction of personal identity, you know, are in the process of being shifted, of mutating. And it's hard to see where that's going to end up. The tendencies that you see now aren't good, in that and it's so dependent upon external approval, it's so dependent on relatively superficial recognitions or legitimations of personal worth, that kind of short circuit what you would have thought of as a prior, maybe even natural process of developing oneself, of developing a sense of self-worth and working on your relations within a particular community. You know, I think that connection between one's identity and a community, that not an online community, like an actual community that you actually talk to and have responsibilities to and so on, I think that connection is splintering. And that's not a good thing if we think that our communities need to survive as all organisms that have mutual responsibilities and care about each other and so on. So that'd be my worry for the future, I guess.
Well, thank you very much for your time. I really was looking forward to this conversation. Definitely didn't disappoint. Is there anything that you want to say before we go? Anything that you want to plug or anything along those lines?
I got a new book out that people
there we go.
have a look at. So yeah, I'll give a plug. It's just called Essays in Media and Cultural Studies, and the semicolon is something like In Transition, I think it is. One of those things with publishing these days, you've got to have a really simple descriptive title. You can't have an imaginary title because it doesn't come up on Google. Anyway, it's a collection of pieces that I've published in journals or in other people's collections rather than in my own books, that I think have got buried, but they all work together. And some of them about celebrity, some of them about the media in the States. So they're kind of relevant to this conversation. So that got published by Routledge late last year. So that's the plug.
Great. Are you doing any Instagram or cultivating your own celebrity online?
No, I guess that's a funny thing in a way. I remember when I started to publish on social media, my son said to me, "Do you actually use social media, Dad?" And I'm on Facebook and WhatsApp, but I really don't actively participate on social media. I did initially, but then I thought, no, I'm not going to do this. And so I said, no, I don't. And so that means there's a limit in what I can say about it. I can talk about the industries to some extent, but I really can't talk with authority about the varieties of usage that individuals engaging with social media, and that's work that actually still needs to be done. You know, there's not a lot of ethnographic work in this area that's not conducted on the offline. You know, the work that actually watches what people do and talks about it. So, yeah, I'm vulnerable to that criticism, I suppose, but I'll admit that I don't have that much to do on social media, mainly for the reasons that I've been going through. I don't actually need that kind of validation in my life. I can do without it. So I have Facebook to create, you know, professional and family connections, and WhatsApp for family, and the rest of it, I just go on the news blogs and media news blogs and so on, where I consume rather than contribute.
I think that's a good thing. We don't need that kind of validation. thank you once again for your time, and I'll send you a link once this is all wrapped up.
Great. Well, good to talk to you, Duncan.
Good to talk to you as well.
Bye bye.
Thank you to Graham Turner, and thank you for listening to Dunk Tank. I'm Duncan Yammy. See you next time.